Freedom versus captivity. The citta, to put it in worldly terms, is like a perpetual captive, someone who is born and lives in captivity, in a prison, someone who never sets foot in the outside world, but lives in imprisonment from infancy to maturity. As a result, he doesn't know about the things that lie outside his confinement. He only knows about the joy and sorrow inside the prison, but he can't see the happiness, the suffering, the freedom, the fun, and the pleasure that belongs to the outside world, nor the way how people out there socialize, how they come and go, and how they make their livelihood. What happens outside, he has no way of knowing, as he is continually confined from his birth to his dying day. This is an analogy. Alone by themselves, both the good times and bad times, found in captivity, has no profound impact, as there are no experiences of the world outside to contrast and compare with. For someone who has never gone out of the penal institution, there is no basis for judgment by which he can say, this is such and such, that is so and so, this is better than that, or that is more superior than this, as nothing outside ever get inside. There are only the experiences of life in confinement. All of his joy and sorrow, his shortcomings, hardships, and oppressions are of the self-same kind, like they have always been. For this reason, he wouldn't know where he can escape to, or how he might free himself, and with what method. And even if he should be able to get outside, he would not know where to live, since he had always been locked up inside the prison, where he is always oppressed, subjugated, beaten up, and tortured, where he always lives in hunger, want, and destitution, and where his bed, his food, and all the living necessities of life are the kinds provided for an inmate. But still he manages to live with them, as he doesn't know what life is like outside. So he cannot compare them and judge as to which is happier to live in. Nor is he encouraged to seek for an exit that would lead him to the world outside. The citta, under the control of the kilesas and asavas, is in the same predicament. That is to say, it has been imprisoned by the various kinds of kilesas for eons and eons. In this present life and since birth, one has been continually subjugated by the domineering kilesas, where not once did one ever have any freedom. It is therefore hard to imagine the kind of happiness that is beyond the state of things one finds oneself in now. It is difficult to perceive what this happiness is like. One is like the person who is born in the prison and who lives there all the time. What is the world beyond like? Is it worth going? Worth living in? Dhamma is being consistently expounded, but not much attention is given to it. Fortunately, there are still some people in some places who still have the interest for Dhamma. In places where no one teaches Dhamma, where no one talks about the world beyond, which is the citta that is imbued with Dhamma, or describes it to other people, then in those places, nobody would know about the Sasana Dhamma, the Dhamma teaching of the Buddha, or know what the happiness arising from the truth and Dhamma is like. Darkness prevails everywhere. People are stuck and totally submerged. This is because they don't have the teaching to salvage them. To them, the world beyond seems far-fetched. What is real to them is just imprisonment, which is their hearts under the control of the kilesas. They are born into this world with the prison as their home, where they live, where they die, and where they remain forever. Their hearts know not what can bring them the happiness and freedom that surpass what they have now. To compare it in another light, they are like ducks wading and splashing on the muddy ground under the house. It is dirty, but they are quite happy playing in it, since they have never seen the water of the great oceans, or the seas, or the ponds, or the pools, where they can freely swim about. They are only used to the drain under the house, so they kept themselves happy and enjoyed themselves by playing and romping in these drain-flooded puddles. And for what reason? It is because they have never seen a greater, wider, and deeper body of water where they can really have fun and a great time, where they can be delighted and at ease, and where they can have more freedom to swim about than in the little puddle under the house. On the other hand, those ducks living along the wide and deep waterways are not like those living under the house. They have good times and the life of pleasure, playing and wading through the streams, the swamps, the creeks, and the ponds. They can follow their keepers wherever he goes, running along crisscrossing the lanes and pathways, going in flocks by the hundreds, by the thousands. These ducks are quite rather happy. What then is the point? To bring it home, the parallel here is the citta, which has never experienced any happiness or ease, or the joy and bliss arising from the truth and Dhamma. It is similar to those ducks playing under the house and those frolicking along the ditches and in the swamps. We are now happy and cheerful due to the influence and manipulation of the kilesas. But this kind of well-being is likened to that of an inmate in a prison. When the citta gets to hear about the Dhamma that flow from the Lokuttara Dhamma, the supramundane Dhamma, it would be enraptured, satisfied, and become interested. Every level of Dhamma has been all elucidated, from Nibbana down through all subsequent levels of Dhamma to the mundane level. There are still some people who have the Upanisaya, the inherent potential for Dhamma, and who are interested in the world beyond and the bliss transcending that they are now experiencing. When they hear the truth and Dhamma, or when they read books dealing with the world beyond, which has to do with the truth and Dhamma, with the release from suffering and pain that always oppress their hearts, they would be enlivened, pleased, and their interest aroused. They would want to hear more about them, would like to take up the practice, and consequently experience the results of practice, step by step. They would have then experienced the flow of the world beyond entering them, be aroused to strive to escape from the oppressions and subjugation within their hearts, which is similar to being a captive within the prison. The more they practice mind development, and the more they experience calm, the harder they would strive and intensify their effort. Correspondingly, mindfulness and wisdom will steadily arise. They would come to see the harm in the oppression of the kilesas and realize the value of Dhamma, which is the means of emancipation. The more they managed to set themselves free, the more their hearts would experience bliss and release, which in turn helps to strengthen their faith tremendously, as well as precipitating their diligence, devotion, and endurance. The mindfulness and wisdom that had previously laid submerged would now return to life to reflect, meditate, and investigate. Despite their past indifference to those things that had been for ages antagonistic to them and had been perpetually hurting them both during the day and night, they would now become concerned with them. Previously, they acted like dead people as they took no interest in those things that came in touch with their eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and heart, but treated them as something trivial, which in turn did not arouse their mindfulness and wisdom to think and examine in terms of causes and their effects. But once their heart had entered the stream of Dhamma, realized by way of practice, and had established this Dhamma as the basis of mindfulness and wisdom, they would then come to see clearly inside their hearts both the harm and the value, as they are both found right within the self same heart. The heart would become keen and skillful in contemplation and investigation. It would become bold in its quest. Seeing the harm, it would try to rectify it. Seeing the value, it would keep on striving and developing more and more of it. This is the way how the citta steadily liberates itself from oppression and control, which is its inner prison. And at the same time, it also catches a glimpse of the world beyond, and see what it is like, and see how it differs from the prison that it is being confined in. It can now see the way how people in the world beyond live, and how they come and go, in contrast to how it is like living inside the prison, and how it is like living under the manipulation of the kilesas. It can also see how it feels like, inside the heart, to have the kilesas steadily diminished. Now it is possible to make these comparisons. Now there is the world beyond to contrast with the world within. This is when the bliss and relaxation, which are the result of one's ability to eliminate the kilesas, now become manifest, and the suffering caused by the surviving kilesas can be readily discerned. One can see their harm with wisdom at every stage, and one continually try to overcome them with unceasing effort. This is the time when mindfulness, wisdom, faith, and energy mobilize and set out on the warpath. It is the time when one sees both the world beyond, which is the removal of the kilesas from the heart, and the inner world, which is being perpetually oppressed by the kilesas. Previously, one did not know what to use as the basis of comparison, as one had not known or seen. Since birth, one had always been submerged in suffering and torment. As far as the bliss from the world beyond, which is the happiness from the truth and Dhamma, is concerned, one had never experienced. The kind of joy that one experiences is the kind that is inherent with suffering, which lies in wait to quietly strike and obliterate that happiness without giving any warning ahead of time. But now one knows and sees some of the extra mundane bliss coming from the world beyond and belonging to one whose heart is imbued with Dhamma. One also sees the joy of captivity, which is the joy under the sway of the kilesas, as well as seeing the suffering under the power of the kilesas. This is knowing them with absolute clarity, within one's heart, with one's own mindfulness and wisdom. One sees the bliss arising from the world beyond, which is the stream of Dhamma that suffuses the heart through and through. And then one uses it as the basis of comparison. One sees both the world beyond and the world within, seeing both the merit and the vanity. By comparing them, one begins to understand them more, as well as becoming more diligent and enduring. One will come to the point when one would contend and overcome, uprooting and removing these oppressive kilesas as soon as one encountered them with the power of mindfulness and wisdom supported by one's strenuous effort. The citta would spin by itself. When the perception of harm is great, so also would be the seeing of the value. The more the desire to see the Dhamma and to gain release, the more intense would one's strenuous exertion has to be. And so must it be with one's endurance, as they are found within the self-same heart. One sees the harm right in the heart. It is this one heart that perceives the damage. It is also this heart that sees the value. It is the business of this heart to strive and exert by the various methods, according to its ability, to attempt the work of self-emancipation. Consequently, all the factors that serve as the instruments and support for the citta, like one's diligent effort, would all spring up at the same time. Hence, satta, the belief in the path and fruit, and the faith in the realm free of dukkha. Viriya, the strenuous exertion that steadily lead on to liberation. Khanti, the endurance needed to put up with the struggle and ensure accomplishment would altogether arise. It is likewise with mindfulness and wisdom that is used in contemplation and reasoning along the line of right and wrong would immediately follow suit. To describe it according to the teaching of the Dhamma principles, this is called Magga Samangi, the gradual convergence of all these factors into the one heart. What collect together? They are right view, right thought, right speech, right action, through to right samadhi. They all converge into this one citta and nowhere else. Samma kammanta, right action, consists of walking practice and sitting in meditation. Samma kammanta is right action. Now that the heart has gone inside, one now enters the subtle level of practice. The citta now attains to Magga Samangi, which is the convergence of the path factors into the one heart. Right view and right thought are the factors of wisdom, which continually probe and examine the nature of the elements and aggregates, and about all the other phenomena that arise and cease, concerning good and evil, past and future, that appear in or come in contact with the heart. Mindfulness and wisdom would strike and obliterate all of them without wasting any time. Samma kammanta, the right action dealing with the body, is the effort applied in sitting in meditation or walking practice, which are the exertions to remove the kilesas in various postures. That which deals with the heart is viriya, the effort applied in the heart. Right speech is to talk about the truth and Dhamma, to converse about the Sallega Dhamma, the Dhamma that purify and cleanse all the kilesas and asavas from the heart. This is to talk about the way how to totally eliminate all the kilesas. This is right speech. What is right livelihood? To take objects that are antagonistic to the citta into the heart and use them as the heart's nutriment is wrong livelihood, as they are inimical to the citta. The citta would become depressed. They are not wholesome and will precipitate suffering inside the heart. The nature of this suffering corresponds directly with the subtleties of the citta. This kind of livelihood is a poison and must be immediately corrected. The kind of thoughts suitable and nutritious for the citta are those which accord with Dhamma, which brings joy, happiness and ease, calm and peace. This is the way of right livelihood. For the citta, it is by way of practicing Dhamma, going up level by level. For the body, it is by way of food, which each Buddhist follower would have to provide himself with by the various means of livelihood, depending on his own occupation or vocation. Samma Vayama, right effort. Where do we apply this effort? We already know this. The Lord exhorted us 4 points where we should concentrate our effort in. Strive in preventing evil from arising within ourselves. Try to let go entirely of those evils already accumulated. In guarding evils, we have to do it with sati. Use this sati to carefully watch and forestall evil by vigilantly look after the citta, which tend to imagine in ways that will gather all the dukkha and misery into the heart. Thinking and imagining about unwholesome things are the works of samudaya, the cause of dukkha. So we must carefully guard it. Don't be negligent. Strive in steadily developing and accumulating wholesome states and wisdom, and try to care for and promote the growth of these wholesome states, not allowing them to degenerate. These 4 right way to exert ourselves are found right within us. Sammasati is to look inside our heart and its various activities. To recollect and be aware is to be constantly attentive. If those things that come in contact with the eyes, ears, nose, tongue and body do not enter the heart, where else could they go? The heart is a vast expanse that at all times receive and perceive all the various kinds of phenomena, both good and evil. Panya reasons and analyzes. Sati continually guards the heart and observes all the things both good and bad, that involve the heart. Satipanya analyzes and selects the various thoughts that interplay with the heart. The citta, or to be precise, panya, will immediately reject and eliminate those thoughts that do not accord with Dhamma. Samma Samadhi is the sustained meditation practice for the calming of the kilesas, for the sake of firmness and stability, that results in peace and coolness of heart. This is the true way of resting the heart, where it is totally devoid of any agitating and disturbing thoughts. This is one aspect. Entering into samadhi is a way of resting the citta and fortify the strength of panya for further work of investigation. One should rest in samadhi by entering into the state of calm and totally desist from imagining, conceiving, examining, and reasoning with panya. Let the citta enter into calm and be at ease. Don't think or imagine about anything, for this is work. Let the citta relax and be still by being suspended in a state of oneness. If the citta is too involved and absorbed with the work of investigation and resist our control, then we must use butto to rein it in by forcing it to continually recite butto, butto, butto. Though this parigama butto is a form of thinking or conceiving, it concentrates on one single Dhamma. And by this method, the citta can attain to calm. This is by continually repeating butto, butto, butto. If the citta still try to sneak away to continue on working, as it is so engrossed with the work and has not yet finished it, then we must increase the rate of reciting our parigama object, not allowing the citta to go out to do more work. There is a stage in the practice where the citta can become engrossed with its work. If we speak in worldly terms, we would say that at this stage, the citta is not liable to be unmindful. But it's really not right to use the term unmindful for the citta of this level. The closest thing we can say is that it cannot relax its efforts. It's a simple way of describing it. The citta just cannot stop, but jump right into the work. At this point, we have to concentrate our efforts in reciting the parigama object, forcing the citta to remain with one particular object, in this case with butto, as a way of stilling the citta. Keep on continually repeating butto, 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 as fast as we can. Then butto and the citta will merge into one, and consequently, the heart would become still. Once it has calmed down, then it will be blissful and will entirely lay down the work. The heart will then become cool. This is right samadhi. When we rest, this is how we should rest. The Lord said this is Samma Samadhi, right Samadhi. When we have rested enough, and the heart has been strengthened, and as soon as we let go of the rein, the citta would immediately spring into action. It will now leave the state of oneness, of one-pointedness, to become dual with the work. The heart must now concentrate on this work without being concerned for samadhi. In the same manner, it must not be concerned with the work while it is developing samadhi for the sake of calm. When it is time to rest, we must rest. When it's time to eat, we must eat. We must not do any other work apart from eating. When it is time to sleep, we must sleep comfortably and not be involved with any kind of work. But when it's time to work, we must not be concerned with eating and sleeping, but really concentrate ourselves in doing the work. This is the way of doing things properly and substantially, at the right and appropriate time. This is Samma Gammanta, right action. The proper way of doing things and in an orderly manner. We cannot disregard samadhi, as it is the practice that keeps the heart joyful. To have the view that samadhi is idling and unproductive is not correct. If we are addicted to samadhi and refuse to do any work, this is not correct either, and must be told so, so that we can give up this habit and start doing some work. But when the citta becomes engrossed with working, then samadhi becomes a necessity. It has its turns and purpose. We cannot go on working forever without resting and sleeping. If we should have to waste some of our resources in feeding our body, then they must be expended with. In return, the body is re-strengthened and will be able to continue on working. Our money and fortune spent to feed our body is productive expenditure. It nourishes and strengthens our body. There is nothing wrong with this kind of spending, for we are not really losing anything. If we don't eat, then where are we going to get the strength from? We have to eat. If this is wasting our resources, then we have to waste it for strength and energy. We are talking about resting in samadhi. When we rest, we must be calm, as this calm is the strength of the citta that will effectively support panya. We must have calm. If there isn't any calm, but a continued functioning of panya, then it's similar to a knife that is never sharpened with a grindstone. It's like chopping with the blunt edge. We are one-sidedly anxious to know, to see, to understand, and to uproot the kilesas. But we neglect to sharpen panya by way of resting in calm, which is a support that brings peace and cool of heart, and strengthen the heart. So it is like an unsharpened knife. It's not easy to cut anything with it, and just waste a lot of our energy. Therefore, to balance things out, when it's time to rest and calm the citta in samadhi, we have to let it take a rest. Taking a rest is similar to sharpening panya with the grindstone. When the body is rested, it gains strength. When the citta is rested, it is re-strengthened. Once having rested, the citta is like a well-sharpened knife. Now back to the self-same question. Self-same panya. Self-same person. Who does the investigation? As soon as he tackles this question, it would now be easily solved. It is similar to a man who has rested and eaten, sharpened his knife, who can now easily chop the self-same piece of wood with the very same knife, because the knife is sharp and the man has regained his strength. Here we have the very same questions, the very same panya, the very same practitioner who has now been resharpened, and the citta that has now regained its strength and capable of backing up panya. The question is now easily solved. A great contrast to when we haven't rested in samadhi. Hence, the practices of samadhi and panya are interrelated. They take their turns. When it's time to do samadhi, we better do it. When it's time to investigate with panya at its fullest capacity, then do it fully. When it's time to rest, then take a total rest. But they must be done at a different time. Don't let them interfere with each other. For example, while we are investigating with panya, don't be concerned with samadhi, and vice versa. This is not correct. We should really lay down one thing and really exert ourselves on the other thing. Concentrate on just one practice at a time. This is correct and proper. Samma samadhi should therefore be practiced in this manner. The kilesas oppress the heart. The citta is like a prisoner. It is at all times overshadowed by the kilesa and asava, and had always been manipulated and harassed by them from the time we were born. As panya steadily extract the kilesa, the heart becomes increasingly brighter. It is burdened citta, a result of the removal of harmful and filthy things, is a gain. We can see its value. Then we continue on investigating. Precisely, where are the kilesas and where are birth and existence? They are right within this one heart. All other things are their branches and divisions, going out by way of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. But the real core is in the heart. When we investigate, all these things will steadily gather into the citta. Is nothing but this very citta that turns and revolves, the one that leads us to be born and die. What is the cause of this? It is due to the origin of these kilesas embedded in the heart. When we have investigated and analyzed with satipanya until seeing clearly, then we will progressively cut them off and draw inward until arriving at the citta, the chief culprit, and avicca, the critical determinant, the origin of vata inside the heart. We must keep on differentiating and investigating until the notions that this is so and so, and that is such and such, are totally vanished. Concentrate on investigating at the citta in the same manner we investigate all the other sapava dhammas. Though the heart may be extremely bright, we have to realize that this is a temporary abode in which we are not yet capable of smashing it into pieces with our investigation. We must not forget that this marvelous citta is the real avicca. We must take it as the target or object of investigation. Should this one dissolve away in such a manner that nothing remains, not even the knowing, or should the one who knows be annihilated along with it, then let's get to know this. We investigate to find out the truth and to know the truth. So we must get right down to the basis of cause and effect, right down to the truth of everything. Should anything be exterminated, let it be so. Finally, should the one who knows, who is doing this investigation, become extinct, along with all the other things, then let us know this with our satipanya. We must not leave anything behind, as they are all elusive, including that which we call I and mine. Investigate into the truth of all these things. What remains after the kilesa and avicca are totally exterminated is that which transcends the reach of samudhi. The Lord called this the pure citta, or the state of purity. The nature of this purity is indestructible. The kilesas are samuti. They arise and they cease. Therefore, they can be removed, increased, or decreased, or totally eliminated, as they have to do with samuti. But the citta alone, the one that has become the vimuti citta, is beyond the reaches of all the kilesas, as they are all samuti. It cannot be damaged by them. But if it has not yet become pure, then it is also samuti, like all the other things, as it is still infected by samuti. But when they are all entirely eliminated, then this vimutti nature can no longer be touched by the kilesas, as it is now beyond their reaches. So what then is annihilated? Dukkha ceases because samudaya already ceased. Nirodha, the extinction of dukkha, ceases. And likewise with magga, the agent that exterminates samudaya. The four Satchadhamma, noble truths, all cease. Dukkha ceases. Samudaya ceases. Nirodha ceases. And magga ceases. Listen to that. What is it that know the cessation of these things? This is the one who is not the Satchadhamma. This one transcends the Satchadhamma. The investigation of the Satchadhamma is solely for this particular one. Once having got to this real thing, the four Satchadhamma then has fulfilled its duty or purpose. There would be no need for more work of purification, correction, or emancipation. Panya has completed its task. We can now let go of Panya. No longer do we have any disciplines. Our weapons of sati and panya are no longer needed. Once the battle is over and all the enemies eliminated, what remains? It is nothing but the state of purity. The Lord Buddha taught Dhamma to the world with this purity. The Dhamma teaching arises from this nature. The substance of this teaching must deal with dukkha, samudaya, nirodha, and magga, as all these things involve the citta. We must know how to correct, how to extinguish dukkha and samudaya, and how to cultivate the magga, until arriving at our destination, which is the state of purity, where we would not have to be taught anymore. The citta has now gone to the world beyond, gone from the prison to the world outside, to freedom, where it would never have to be confined again. But nobody likes to go to this world, since nobody has ever seen it. This is an important world, Lokuttara, the supramundane world, is a realm higher than all other worlds. But let's just call it the world beyond. It's beyond all forms of samuti. We label it as world, because we are living in the world of samuti. We must investigate on how to get out of this prison. We have been born, lived, and died in this prison. Never once have we ever died outside this prison. Try to get this heart out of this prison, so that we can attain to bliss, like the Lord Buddha and the Savaka. They also were born in the prison, but they all died outside the prison. They all died in the world beyond. They did not die in this confined world. Than Ajahn Mun said, the heart has only one universal language. Regardless of language or nationality, there is only one knowing, and that is the heart. As soon as we bring something to mind, we can understand it right away. But when we have to speak it out, then it has to be put into this or that language. And then it is more difficult to understand. But our awarenesses in the citta are all identical. Dhamma and the heart are therefore a perfect match. Dhamma is the language of nothing but the heart. It stays with the heart. Both sukha and dukkha are in the heart. It is the heart which generates them by virtue of its own thinking. This sukha and dukkha are the result of this thinking, and the heart must experience and bear them. Both the heart and Dhamma are perfectly suited to each other, regardless of nationality or speech. If it accords with Dhamma, it is always compatible with the heart, and both the heart and Dhamma are right and fitting for each other. The heart is the core within our body, the fundamental and substantial part, an important essence. Such is the heart, and it is preeminent. The conditions arising from the heart, like thought and imaginings, all rise and cease like ripples. The heart stirs itself up when it thinks and imagines. Sanya is perception, imagination, and memory. When a thought is long and extended, it is sanya. When it is short and momentary, it is sankhara. Sanya is perception, memory. Vijnana is the acknowledgement of the contact between the sense objects and the sense organs. For example, when a form contacts the eyes, there arises an awareness of this contact. All of them continually arise and cease, for this is their inherent nature. The Lord referred to them as the khandhas, groups or categories. These five khandhas continually arise and cease. All the arahants have khandhas just like ordinary people, with the difference that their khandhas are pure and free from the domineering kilesas, which direct the heart to think and imagine. Their khandhas think naturally and freely. This type of citta is not manipulated to think and imagine, like the citta of ordinary people. Speaking comparatively, the khandhas of ordinary people are like those of a prisoner, who is continually controlled and manipulated. All his thoughts, imaginings, and perceptions are manipulated. They are being directed to think about this or imagine about that, or to perceive in this or that fashion. In other words, the kilesas are the master that manipulate the khandhas to function. This is not true for the arahants. When they imagine, they do it naturally. As soon as they imagine, this imagination ceases right away. There is no agent to keep the citta going, and no agent to weigh it down. There is nothing to control it, in contrast to the khandhas, under the sway of the kilesas, and have the kilesas as their master. So in this respect, the cittas are different, although their true natures are all the same. All the above mentioned are anicjang, impermanent. Changeability is inherent in each and every khanda, namely the rupa khanda, which is our body, and the vedana khanda, which comprises sukha, dukkha, and neutral feelings. They all continually rise and cease, as do sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. Their inherent nature is to continually rise and cease. On the other hand, the true knowing, which is the basis of our awareness of the things that rise and cease, does not itself cease. It is impossible for us to say that the citta ceases, or that the citta rises. Consequently, a purified citta is totally rid of both the issue of birth and death, and also the dhatu and the khanda. A purified citta does not take birth in the various realms of existence, nor does it manifest itself in any physical form, such as an animal or person. But for those people whose cittas are not purified, they will continue taking on birth and death, and will keep on heading for the cemetery. And it is all due to this undying citta. Therefore the Lord Buddha taught Dhamma to the world, especially the world of humans, because we are the ones capable of knowing about good and evil, about what is wholesome and unwholesome, about what is beneficial and harmful, and about the way of correction, alteration, and cultivation. We are the ones who can comprehend the language that he used to teach the Dhamma. Therefore, teaching the human world was the first priority, and took precedence over the other worlds, so that we may try to modify and correct the things that we see to be useless and harmful, and remove them from our heart, body, and speech. He also taught us to develop and cultivate goodness, to promote the growth of existing virtue, and to bring about new wholesome states. We are to keep on maintaining and nourishing the good already accumulated, to use this to nurture the heart, to provide it with coolness, peace, and happiness, to equip it with a basis of Dhamma and goodness. Should it depart from the existing dhatu khanda and go on to a different birth and existence, the citta that is constantly being nourished by good and virtue will be a good citta. It will proceed to a good state. And if it is born again, it will go to a good birth. Live a good life, always be happy, and eventually be able to transcend the wheel of existence. This is made possible by the support of its faculty, power, potential, and virtue, all gradually and continually built up in the past. For example, yesterday is today's past. Today is tomorrow's past. They all are days which we spent developing wholesome states that will powerfully strengthen and support the citta, which will eventually pass beyond. Samuti is birth and death, and covers even the most subtle and tranquil realms of existence. Those who have absolutely passed beyond the realm of rebirth, like the cittas of the Arahants and the Lord Buddha, are devoid of samuti. Concerning this subject, there is the story of the Venerable Wangisa. Ever since he had been a layman, he was an expert in seeing the cittas of the dead and where they may have ended up. He could do it with the citta of anybody. I wouldn't really call him a fortune teller, more just an expert in the occult. When people brought the skull of a departed one to him, he would tap on it a few times. He would then concentrate his mind and would know the rebirth of this particular citta. He could tell if it was reborn as a being in hell, or went to heaven, or was born subhuman as a preta, or as a ghost. He could tell it all, as long as he was given the skull of the deceased. When he heard from his friends that the Lord Buddha was much more accomplished than himself, he became interested in acquiring more knowledge, and so went to see the Lord Buddha to learn more about his branch of knowledge. When he met the Lord Buddha, he was given the skull of an arahant, and was told, "Try this, see where this one has gone." He tapped and listened, but there was silence. Again he tapped and listened. Again there was silence. He meditated on it, but still, silence. Contemplated again, still, silence. He was unable to discern where the former possessor of this skull had gone to. When he was at the end of his wits, he frankly confessed, "I really don't know where this one has gone to." At the outset, the Venerable Wangisa thought himself brilliant and clever, and so he went to challenge the Lord Buddha. This was before becoming his disciple. He was given the skull of an arahant to do his tapping, and at this point, he got stuck. He now wanted to take up the learning, because now he could become incredibly great. As it happened, he asked the Lord Buddha to be his teacher. Thus the Lord Buddha taught him the knowledge and the way, namely, the knowledge of Dhamma. He then constantly practiced and developed until he attained his goal and became an arahant. Thereafter, he was no longer interested in tapping anyone's skull apart from his own. When he knew clearly and penetratively, he was rid of all problems. This is the correct way to tap ahead. Here we are referring to the citta which doesn't take rebirth. Despite his expertise, the Venerable Wangisa was unable to know where a purified one had gone to take a new birth. A purified citta has no rebirth. Consider the Venerable Gaudika. Here is another valuable lesson. When he was cultivating Dhamma, his practice kept on fluctuating, advancing, and deteriorating again and again for about half a dozen times. The seventh time, he on the verge of slitting his throat with a razor, cried, "Oh, I am greatly disappointed." But he was able to gather his senses. He continued contemplating Dhamma and finally became an arahant. Of course, this is just a brief sketch of his story. When he passed away, all the great Maras came and sought for his departed citta. As we might say, they left no stone unturned, but were still unsuccessful in their search. Little did they know where he went to take birth again. The Lord Buddha said this to them: "In no way, either by digging, searching, investigating, or turning over the ground, would you find the departed citta of Gaudika, the son of the Tathagata, and an accomplished one." It is beyond the range and means of Samuti, so how could you ever find it? It is beyond the ability of people with kilesas to know the power of the Arahant's citta. Nobody in the realm of Samuti can trace the whereabouts of the Arahant's citta, because they have already departed from Samuti, even though their cittas are similar to ours. Try to investigate and see it for yourself. When we consistently and relentlessly cleanse our citta, which is now unstable, it will become increasingly subtle via this effort, and subsequently extremely subtle. Eventually this subtlety will all disappear, because it is Samuti. Remaining is an immaculate nature comparable to pure gold, or the ultimate Dhamma, which we call the pure citta. Then our problems will all vanish, like those of the Arahants. For our citta is now as supreme as theirs, already gone beyond. This type of citta can be realized by both men and women. So far as the sexes are concerned, they are one form of Samuti. The citta, however, is sexless. Men and women can be equally competent and skillful with Dhamma. They can attain to succeeding levels of Dhamma, all the way to Vimutti, freedom. In this respect, they are unimpeded by anything. What we need are sufficient levels of skill, power, and vasana, virtue accumulated in the past, because this will enable us to cross over. Therefore, we must try to train and develop our citta. At very least, we should try for the state of calm and coolness. By using any effective Dhamma that succeeds in making the citta calm. The result will be a cool and happy heart. The particular device that we use will be the controlling agent, the refuge and anchor of the citta, especially anapanasati, mindfulness of in and out breathing, which is an important gammatthana subject within the circle of practice. Anapanasati seems to be the dhamma which suits the character and personality of most people. It is used more widely than the other dhammas, and we should take it to heart, so that our heart can become quiet and peaceful. When the heart enters into calm, we will begin to see its essence, begin to penetrate its nature. When the citta gathers its flow into one point, and has just the knowingness manifesting within that state, this is what the Lord called the citta. The citta's degree of convergence depends on the citta's own ability, its level, and its subtlety. If the citta is still coarse, when it converges, one may still know what it is like. When it is subtle, we will know its more subtle aspects. For instance, we will know that the citta is subtle, that it is bright and clear, that it is extremely calm, that it is supremely marvelous, or that it is becoming increasingly more developed. And we also know that all this is happening to this very citta. Our object is for purity, for development and training, for calm investigation, research, and for correcting the problems of the heart with panya. These are the methods which enable the development of the citta to steadily advance and to gradually penetrate its true nature. No matter how gross the heart may be, if we persist with our effort, continue to strive and exert ourselves, this grossness will steadily disappear. The disappearance will correspond to our degree of exertion and ongoing drive. Eventually, whether man or woman, we will each pass beyond and realize freedom. We will have cut and struck down the kilesas completely, exterminating them. As long as we are still incapable of doing this, our heart should not be anxious, but instead establish a basis for itself. Then we will be our own support and refuge. We have depended on our body since birth. We all know this. We have been living with it, putting it to sleep, discharging its waste, putting it to work, and making a living with it. Each mutually uses and manipulates the other. For example, we force it to do work, and it subjects us to dukkha and pain in the various parts of the body. Then we have to go and look for medicines to cure this pain. It is this body which is afflicted with pain, and it is the one who has to find the cure. And it is the one who must pursue money and things. This is how we keep on supporting each other. It is not certain as to who has the upper hand. Is it the Dhadukhanda or us? We only have temporary control over it, but it reigns over us all the time. Sickness and affliction, hunger and thirst, sleepiness and lethargy. These are dukkha which the body put us through. It has complete control of us, and we possess very little control over it. So when the time is right to force it to practice bhavana, we must really do it. When the dhadukhanda is healthy and normal, we can exert in our practice at any intensity. But when the dhadukhanda is afflicted, unhealthy, and abnormal, we must know what it can handle. But the exertion of the heart must go on and must not be led to sleep, because it is an essential undertaking. We have depended on this body for ages. Now that it is ailing and malfunctioning, we should face facts. We should know its capacity for work, because we are its possessor. We have to reduce and relax accordingly. The heart, however, is not afflicted as the body is. Therefore, it should intensify its internal exertion, so that it doesn't miss out on the benefit to be gained. We must develop a principle for the heart. While we live with a basis. When we die with a basis. Wherever we take birth, we should live with a sound principle that keeps us happy and contented. The goodness and virtue which we look forward to should not be allowed to go astray. We should always have things that bring us satisfaction and contentment. This will accord with our practice for the development of good and virtue, that is, the happiness sought by all people, and which people are never satiated with. Such is the nature of happiness, always wanted in any form, especially the heart's happiness arising from cultivating good and virtue, as from the practice of bhavana. Such happiness is the core, the important essence of the heart. We should therefore cultivate it while the dhadukhanda lives. Once we reach the end of life, development will be beyond our capacity. However much or little we have achieved, we must stop at that time. Then we are laid off and retired from our job to await its result in the next stage, over there in the next life. Over there. We should do whatever we can. If we can pass beyond and realize freedom, then all our problems and troubles will be entirely taken care of. Nothing to bother and involve us anymore. Here we are talking about the citta, which is preeminent and which can lead us to good or evil, happiness or suffering. Nothing but the citta can produce these things. Karma and its result are both in the citta. The citta is their creator. It makes no difference whether we remember them or not. And because karma's agent is in the heart, its consequences cannot be blocked. It is deeply rooted in the citta. We must accept the consequences of our karma, but we shouldn't blame anyone else. What we did is already done. Why blame anything? When we write with our hand, we must use our own hand to rub it out. We should accept it like a sportsman. Such is the way with karma. When we have realized freedom, then all our troubles will disappear. End of Detsana.